Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and so much more, and we have a marvelous show for you this week. Contributor Rachel Llewellyn will be here to talk to me about Ripley, a new adaptation of, basically, of The Talented Mr. Ripley by Patricia Highsmith, which is now airing in glorious black and white on Netflix. I have some mixed opinions about the show, and so does Rachel, and she will be here to talk to me about it. And I'm also going to talk to frequent contributor Scott Gold about X-Men 97, a new nostalgic and fun animated superhero show airing on Disney Plus. Much to talk about there. But first, Stephen Garrett is here as always, and we're going to talk about Monkey Man, the new Hong Kong style, John Wick style, Hindu mythology style action flick from actor and writer and director Dev Patel. And Stephen will be here to talk to me about that right after this interlude.
When I was a boy, my mother used to tell me a story of a demon king and his army. They brought fire and terror to the land until they faced the protector of the people, the white monkey.
You need to fight for all of us.
Spooky.
Our movie of the week is Monkey Man, directed by Dev Patel, partly written by Dev Patel, and starring Dev Patel. It's a real Dev Patel kind of movie. It is the most Dev Patel movie ever made.
It really is, isn't it?
I would say.
Yeah, there's a lot of Dev.
This is Dev's mind and body all over the screen. And Stephen Garrett is here to talk to me about Monkey Man. You know what? This is a really interesting picture, Stephen, because...
Yeah.
On the one hand, it's an homage to Hong Kong action pictures, but also to like Park Chan-wook style Korean revenge flicks. Like this guy, Dev Patel has seen Old Boy many times. You know, there's a lot of Old Boy references in this, but it's also a savage indictment of Indian class inequality, and it's also kind of a boxing and wrestling picture. And there's a lot of Hindu mythology in this movie. It's a mishmash. It is a real kitchen sink grab bag of a flick.
I didn't feel like it was that much of a savage indictment. It felt like a little bit of shorthand of an indictment about Indian caste society and politics. I mean, kind of like how Slumdog Millionaire kind of did that, but not really.
Little Slumdog. Although I will say this, may not know this about me, Stephen, but I went to yoga school.
Oh,
all right. And I'm a certified yoga instructor, so I'm pretty familiar with all these myths, with the myth of Hanuman and the Ramayana, which in some ways the movie tries to retell in a kind of Pulp Fiction-y sort of way. And the main villain of the film is the dirty police chief who like burned down Dev Patel's character's village. But really, it's this false guru who is manipulating the masses through this fake version of yoga. And he has this Narendra Modi style politician under his thumb. And he's the real bad guy. He's like the devil who, Dev Patel's fallen monkey man god has to try to defeat. Now, that makes it all sound like this is a mythological movie, but it takes place in a kind of a gritty Indian city setting, modern Indian city setting.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I kind of felt like, I guess this guy's Baba Shakti, right? The spiritual guru. Yes. We saw more of him than anybody else in terms of these corrupt figures. You know, like I feel like we saw more of him pop up unexplained. I mean, the movie's kind of scrambled egg in terms of its editing, right?
Oh, yeah. And its narrative structure. And I feel, no one was telling Dev no. You should have said no maybe a couple of times.
Yeah, I mean, not a pushback a little bit. Then he's Monkey Man. Let him have it. You know, the Modi stuff. I kind of felt like we saw that guy towards the end of the movie. Like I thought this spiritual guru was the head of India in this fictional kind of version of India.
No, it kind of works like that in Indian politics and society. The politicians are secular figures, but you have these gurus who pop up every now and then and sort of manipulate things. You know, he's a snake oil salesman. Like, he does all the yoga poses. He's, you know, he meditates. He plays the game of spirituality, but it in fact is like, you know, evil incarnate.
Right. No. And I dug that, but it's just the actual political figure that he is controlling is kind of mentioned like in passing, because there's an election coming up that's tied to Diwali, I think.
Well, it takes place on Diwali, and you know, and Dev Patel has some social justice goals, like the Indian Hindu nationalists are persecuting Muslims and transgender people. Who, by the way, the transgender priests live in a secret temple, and they teach Dev Patel how to box.
Right, to a funky drummer, yeah.
To a funky tabla playing, and so you know, look.
It's really enjoyable.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, look, it is a real pulpy, fun movie, and I think it'll have a lot. I think it'll have appeal to certain kinds of audiences. My favorite scenes, and I wish there were more of them, and I wish they had been grittier, even a little more drawn out, were the boxing scenes where Dev Patel puts on the monkey mask, yeah, and he engages in these cage fights. And I love the Charlto Copley, the South African actor, plays this really sleazy fight entrepreneur. We don't even get his name, and he doesn't really get any backstory, and he doesn't get any comeuppance. He's just kind of like this Dickensian South African fight operator in the middle of India. He is. Every moment he's on screen is extremely enjoyable. You know, I felt like Dev Patel, which is often a problem with Dev Patel, he takes himself very, very seriously.
Well, and he's trying to make himself John Wick as well, right?
Like, yeah, and Jesus.
Yeah.
and you know, he's got a nice bod in this. He handles the action scenes very well. There's some cool shots. I love that shot where they're a lot of the action takes place in this, like, basically like a high-end whorehouse, right?
Cocaine
bar or whatever, where the rich people go to.
Run by Queen Kapoor. It's called Kings, right? Because she's the queen of kings.
Right. And, you know, there's this great shot. I mean, there's a great shot sort of toward the end, one of the fights is where he's standing on top of the bar and the bar's all brown lit behind him. And
right.
There are a number of really excellent stills.
So stylish. I mean, the cinematography and the fight choreography, I mean, it's really beautifully packaged I guess produced. I would say directed to a certain extent. I did feel like he
over-directed.
Very stylish, a very simplistic story, I felt as well. Like, and
you know, it is a simplistic story, but it's also somehow overwritten with flashbacks.
Right. Which are redundant flashbacks. We keep seeing the same flashback, and we're like, I get it. Yeah, he's a bad cop who raped your mom. I get it. You know what I mean? Like,
it's like the same scene over and over again, just little bits and pieces.
Exactly.
I just feel like this is my preference coming through here, Stephen, but I like a more streamlined narrative structure.
Oh, you know? Me too.
You don't need the hints and this and that. You need tell the story is good.
I think the story is fine, but it's underdeveloped. And I think they felt like they needed to make it feel more interesting. So they did that classic thing where they scramble the narrative to make it seem more complex than it actually is, you know?
And the characters are, you know, they don't give the characters any room to breathe. You know, there's this sort of the tuk-tuk driver who is sort of Dev Patel's accomplice. He's pretty funny, and he's like played by an Indian comic actor. I don't remember I don't remember his name. But he kind of vanishes toward the end of the movie, and we don't really see any development for him. And, you know, and just in general, even Dev Patel's character is, I mean, he calls himself Bobby, but his name is really just The Kid. Like, he's some kind of Clint Eastwood hero.
Yeah, or Prince from Purple Rain, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
The Kid. What about this girlfriend? What's the love interest? There's like a kindred spirit. I think they grew up in the same forest or something.
But they don't.
She's got that tattoo of the bird.
Yeah, but that's all. What's her name? Do you know?
I don't even know. And she comes up. She comes back towards the end and is kind of helps him out or whatever.
Yeah.
Right?
What's her name? So there's a lot missing in this movie. I feel like, you know, someone, a friend of mine said that he felt like Dev Patel had first movie-itis. And again, like this, you know, he's a relatively major Hollywood figure. He had this thing, he made it. Jordan Peele got behind it. No one's going to tell that crew no.
Well, and about anything. Should they? I mean, this is really, like you said, I mean, it's a fun pulpy ride. I mean, it really, like, it's stylish. You're seeing it for the action. That's all you need. you know, don't take it too seriously.
Well, I guess, although, you know, there are, you know, Indian writers and critics who are taking it seriously because it is. Because it has some there's some depth to the criticism of the way that Hinduism is used to manipulate the masses in India. So for, you know, for you and I, yes, we can see it as just like another John Wick knockoff or a honk. I saw John Wick, but there's a lot of Park Chan-wook revenge thriller in this as well. But right, I think that there's an added level of depth and sophistication in the Indian content itself. My problem with the movie is not with the action, and it's not with that stuff, which is very interesting. It's just with the choppy way in which it's told, the flashbacky narrative, the poorly developed characters. It's a mixed bag. I mean, I gave it 4 stars, you know,
right,
out of 5. It's a kinetic experience.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. You know, it was involving, and, you know, and again, those fight scenes in the Monkey Mask are fucking fantastic.
They're great. I mean, it's a real passion project. You know, clearly he is having a ball doing this. Clearly Jordan Peele had a ball watching it, wants to support it. I mean, it's,
yeah,
all good things. I wish all good things for the film and for his, you know, kind of directing career.
It is a possible genre breakout too in the U.S. You know, it's not a Bollywood movie; it's a Western movie with Indian characters. But there's been a, you know, with that RRR thing on Netflix last year, there's sort of a rise of interest in like Indian action heroes.
Yeah,
and you know, Monkey Man's not a big hit. You know, it's done modestly well, but I think that it will. If I'm guessing, is going to pave the way for similar type movies.
Yeah, yeah, more animal themed action films. I love the title.
It's a great title, and you know it. And there's a lot of monkey. There's a lot of monkey masks. There's and Hanuman. Hanuman is the Indian monkey god that they're referring to in the movie, and he certainly plays a big part as well. So look, I recommend it. I think it's worth talking about. It's definitely worth criticizing. And I don't think this is the last we're going to see of Dev Patel, I think. And if we do, he does make another movie. I pretty much guarantee he's going to be in every scene. I don't think he lacks self-regard.
I like Dev. I got no problems with Dev. I enjoy Dev. I like seeing Dev. Do you see him in Great Expectations? That was kind of wild.
Yeah, that wasn't very the Armando Iannucci Great Expectations.
Yeah, the Armando Iannucci one. Yeah, yeah. I kind of dug it.
Yeah,
it was very sweet.
Very sweet. Yeah, exactly. Just like Monkey Man. So sweet.
Just so sweet, like Monkey.
What a sweet exactly. little movie. All right, Monkey Man's in theaters now. Stephen Garrett, I will talk to you soon.
Tom Ripley.
Tom Ripley.
Thomas Ripley.
I like the name.
Ripley.
All the self-consciously literary people I know are talking about Ripley, which is a new adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley, now airing on Netflix. Unfortunately, it feels like the self-consciously literary people are the only people talking about Ripley. It's a very self-consciously literary TV show, and are not self-conscious, but sometimes literary critic. Rachel Llewellyn is here to talk to me about Ripley. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me on today.
Yes. So you messaged me and you said, have you been watching Ripley? I think it's pretty good. And it's funny. Like, I've had a lot of people say, have you been watching Ripley? I think it's pretty good. Or I think it's pretty bad. I'm a well-known aficionado of the books of Patricia Highsmith. I've read all the Ripley novels. I've seen most of the adaptations of the Tom Ripley stories. I've seen the weird John Malkovich one. I saw the fantastic Wim Wenders, Dennis Hopper, Tom Ripley. And of course, the 1990s, The Talented Mr. Ripley, a very celebrated film, you know, starring Matt Damon and Jude Law and Gwyneth Paltrow, Philip Seymour Hoffman, etc. But this one, this is the most Ripley we've ever seen. This is 8 hours of Ripley.
It's the Ripleyest Ripley, yes.
It is 8 hours. And it's in black and white. Very black. It's like self-consciously black and white. Like it's beyond a stylistic choice. It's almost like a tick. I mean, the shadows, a lot of the show takes place in sunny beachside Italy. And yet it's still very shadowy and moody.
Yes, it's a very, I would say, chiaroscuro, which seemed to be a very purposeful stylistic choice by the director, Stephen Zalian.
Zalian.
Zalian, yeah. Pronounced Alien. but he is a very talented guy. And he doesn't have a huge, like, director, like, his writing resume is longer than his directorial one. He like wrote and directed, you know, Searching for Bobby Fischer. But this is, you know, this is definitely a departure for him. And I think he purposely went after like the Caravaggio style, like really playing with light and shadow, black and white. I think it was a really good stylistic choice personally, because I think it really kind of deepened some of the drama and kind of forced some of the more psychological aspects of the story to the fore.
Yeah, I've seen people complaining about the look of the show. That is not my complaint. I think it looks gorgeous. You know, it is every shot is very intricately composed. And the black and white, I think, actually adds to the detail rather than distracts from it. My problem with Ripley is the story, I guess, for lack of a better term. You know, I'm so enamored with the 1990s, The Talented Mr. Ripley. And that's essentially what this show is. It's an adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley. It's not like, you know, there's lots of Ripley books, but the show doesn't really like go into the other eras of Ripley's life. And, you know, that movie is so iconic and glamorous and entertaining. It's full of star power. And this feels very buttoned up and starchy by comparison. You know, Andrew Scott, who plays Ripley, is an excellent actor, but he's not kind of oily and charismatic like Matt Damon was in the 1990s version. Would you agree?
Right, I would definitely agree. I think that one man's starchy is another person's stripped down in terms of just skeletonizing the story and really playing with its elemental parts. And I think that making Ripley a little bit more like kind of icy, a little more blank, if you will, a lot of people found him that kind of a real turnoff, Andrew Scott's interpretation of Ripley. But what he was saying, Andrew Scott himself was talking about his role and how he felt free to really make him less psychopathic and more of just kind of someone reacting to everything around him. It really,
and he's more of just a straight up con man.
Yeah.
You know,
yes, exactly.
More of just like a hustler who's trying to make a buck, which I appreciated. You know, I Andrew Scott was not my problem with the movie. My real problem was Johnny Flynn and Dakota Fanning as Dickie Greenleaf and Marge, because, you know, in the movie you have Jude Law, the tannest anyone has ever been in a movie, I think, outside of maybe George Hamilton. It was just so like beautiful and magnetic. And then, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow at her absolute Gwynethist, you know, so beautiful, so many wonderful headscarves in that film. And also, like, let's not forget, you know, we have Philip Seymour Hoffman and Cate Blanchett in early roles, right? Mm-hmm. There's no cast that you can put in a black and white 8-hour Netflix adaptation of Ripley that could even come close to matching. That is the one of the best casts in movie history, I think.
Absolutely agree. Yeah, you couldn't be more right. I think the cast is pretty, you know, in terms of just intensity, you're right. I don't think that they can compare in terms of performance, for sure. And there's a lot of, you know, folks who were kind of debating that. And you're right, Philip Seymour Hoffman absolutely can't be beat. They did kind of gender queer that role a little bit for this series, which was interesting to see how that was played by, I believe, the person's name is...
Look it up.
Last name Summers. It's I'm losing it.
Summers.
In any case.
Yes.
Wonderful cast. You can't beat the 90s role. You just can't. And Matt Damon, like you said, the oily kind of obsequiousness, it just doesn't come through with Andrew Scott.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a coldness, and I'm just like, who is this show for? To me, like, it feels like a show that is exclusively for people who still read the New York Review of Books. You know, it's like, you know, it doesn't have a ton of entertainment value. You know, the thing that makes, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the other Ripley movies, but like Wim Wenders, The American Friend, it's an art house movie, and you can watch it on the Criterion channel anytime. It's an art house movie, but it's super entertaining. It's got a gripping noir plot. The Talented Mr. Ripley, super entertaining, gripping noir plot. Strangers on a Train, which is not The Talented Mr. Ripley, but might as well be, you know, the original one, not the remake. One of the great movies of all time. And this is just like, this is more of a show that seems to say, like, I've read Patricia Highsmith. I've thought about Patricia Highsmith. I am familiar with the oeuvre of Patricia Highsmith, and I shall make an 8-hour chiaroscuro miniseries on Netflix about it.
Yeah, it's indeed. Indubitably. It's like, well, it's highfalutin for sure. And that's really what I like about the character of Ripley is he's kind of like the thinking man's Bond. You know, it's a really loose character where you can attribute and interpret that character and his world and his thought process so many different ways. And I think that's what's so interesting about, you know, these stories that come from the perspective of the con man. You know, I'm thinking series is like You.
Yes. Yeah, he's sort of a proto you. He's sort of a proto Joe.
Yeah, he's a proto.
I mean, look. I mean, look. I love you, but compared to Joe, what Goldberg and you, you know, Ripley is like Hercule Poirot. You know, he's not just like randomly murdering women he gets a boner for in a bookstore. You know, he's like the plot's kind of like spring up out of nowhere, and he sometimes like situations just force him into action. Like he doesn't ask to go to Italy. Right. He's not looking to go like stalk and impersonate Dickie Greenleaf. He literally like gets approached in a bar and some guy's like, here's $1 million or something like that.
And the character itself is written like a con man. He's written like a con man. He's so adaptable. He's so flexible. He reacts to everything that's around him and he tries to make the best of it. And that's what's so interesting about this character, you know, all these iterations and this black and white one, which seems to me more valuable maybe with the mute button on and played during like a classy dinner party.
A classy dinner party celebrating the 75th anniversary of the New Yorker books issue. Honestly, like my favorite episode of the show was actually the first episode before he gets to Italy, because at least there's some fresh material. Like at least we see kind of Ripley like hustling around early Mad Men New York, like running his insurance scams. You know, just kind of like, you know, you see him in his griminess, which also is available in The American Friend. You see a little bit of Ripley before he goes off to Europe and works the con. You see that he just kind of like, he's like sitting there in his pod waiting to be activated.
Yes. Yeah, right? Exactly.
And that's kind of cool. But then once he gets to Italy, then you're kind of in a 7-hour version of something that you saw in 2 hours and 15 minutes 30 years ago.
Right, exactly.
It's not a new story.
Yeah, it's really not.
Obviously, you like it more than I do. Like, I'm a little... I just want TV to be entertaining, Rachel. I can't help it.
Well, it's definitely, like, aesthetically, you know, it's meaningful aesthetically. But you're right. If you're looking for entertainment, storyline, characters that really render these stories well, you're not probably going to be super satisfied with this series. You know, again, you put it on mute. Hey, it's pretty beautiful. You could pause any frame and put it on your wall. It's just gorgeous to watch. But, you know, there are a lot of...
If you want to watch a guy if you're going to watch a guy walk up and down the stairs for 15 minutes.
Right. Lots of stairs in this. I, we get it, man. It's a metaphor. You're socially climbing. It's all throughout. And it's shot like a Gucci ad, you know?
Yeah, you know, and then there's the fact that, like, you know, I believe that, you know, the denouement of The Talented Mr. Ripley is about 30 to 40 minutes long in the movie. Or short, you know, it's like Dickie Greenleaf, spoiler alert, Ripley kills him. But that happens, you know, that doesn't happen, it happens later, and it doesn't happen early in the movie. Whereas, you know, you got like 5 hours, 5 hours of this, of the investigation. You know, of Ripley, like, running, hiding. 5 hours is a long denouement of an 8-hour show. The pacing's a little off.
It was definitely a little heavy. Yeah, it was a little caboose heavy there at the end. I think the intent, like the artistic intent seems to be to sort of focus more on Ripley's reactions to things. I really liked the Inspector Ravini character, Maurizio Lombardi. I think he was really one of the standout roles.
Yeah, he was really good. Maybe we could have a whole Inspector Lombardi mysteries.
Oh, the
series spinoff.
Would watch.
Spinoff series.
Pinkies up.
10 out of 10 would watch. All right. Well, look, obviously Ripley is, we're going to agree to disagree on this one, Rachel. I have my criticisms as you can tell, but right now I have to go, forge some medical receipts so I can pay for my lunch.
Pinkies up.
We have to stay vigilant. The professor entrusted us with his dream. To me, my X-Men.
90s kids will remember the X-Men cartoons from the 90s, from 1992 to be exact. I wasn't really a 90s kid. I was more of an 80s kid, but I will admit that I would still occasionally watch superhero cartoons in the 1990s. I guess I'm not ashamed to admit it, although I am kind of ashamed. I'm familiar with the X-Men cartoons from the 1990s, and Marvel has brought them back on a new series on Disney Plus. It's called X-Men 97, and it's very true to the old X-Men cartoons. In fact, some could say that there's no difference between the old X-Men cartoons and the new ones. And Scott Gold has written about X-Men 97 for us and is here today to talk to me about it. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Neil. Great to be back on the podcast.
Yeah. So I'm glad you were able to, overcome your prejudices against mutants to watch this show.
Yeah, those damn mutants, you know, they're trying to take over all of humanity and it must be stopped.
Yeah, or not. So all the old X-Men themes are back, right? You know, the mutants versus humanity, et cetera, et cetera. But I've noticed, like, I've watched the first four episodes of X-Men 97 now. And, you know, I feel like the show is going a little bit away from sort of traditional X-Men themes and delving kind of deep into like weird comics lore. Wouldn't you say that's the case?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, in the first four episodes, we're treated to a lot of really bizarre storylines that are drawn directly from those arcs that were in the comics. And that's kind of a fun part for the comic geeks who really love the source material is like, oh, you know, what are they going to mine next and how are they going to do it? And, you know, X-Men, I was really, when they announced that they were going to do this show, I was scared because, we've been treated to so many retreads and reboots and revivifications of old properties because apparently, like, no one wants to be original anymore. And, or at least no one, you know, on these big platforms wants to try something new. And I was like, oh God, they're going to butcher another beloved thing from my past. But the wonderful thing is they are not just so true to the show from the 90s. It is a direct continuation of the series from the 90s, taking up from exactly where they left off in 1997, which is awesome.
Right. And so, you know, we've seen the Professor X versus Magneto thing play out so many times in live action movies. We've seen the Dark Phoenix saga twice. So they're not doing that again. They're doing these other storylines with these other villains and these other things from lore. And there's a lot of phantasmagoria and body horror. It's it's great. It's actually really good. But it's definitely like not for the uninitiated. Like you had better be pretty familiar with the source material if you're going to really want to enjoy this stuff.
Yeah. And I think that's par for the course for any series that is a continuation. You know, this is, you know, season six of a show that, you know, veered wildly from sci-fi trope to sci-fi trope. You know, in one episode, they're doing mind battles in some weird telekinetic other realm. And then the next episode, they're on dinosaurs. And it's like,
they go into space, they go into other dimensions. Sometimes there's this there's this sort of video game parody, this cyberpunk thing in this season. There's like definitely like horror, like legitimate horror.
Oh yeah. There's I believe it's the third episode, which is my favorite so far, is like direct homages to David Cronenberg, like a lot of like gross, fleshy kind of animation. But the great thing is that that's what they can do, this being an animated series. Like I can't even imagine how much it would cost to try and film a live action version of this. Not to mention the fact that if you did a live action version of any of these plots, it would be too hard and it would be terrible. It would fail miserably.
It wouldn't make any sense. Let us not forget the source material for all of this stuff is comic books, right?
Yeah.
So this is a comic book come to life in every way, which, I mean, you're from the 90s. You remember, like, superhero live action movies were particularly bad, with very few exceptions in the 90s. But it was a good time for cartoons, for superhero cartoons, especially Marvel ones. They had the Spider-Man series, the X-Men series. There's Batman, the animated series, and the Superman animated series on the DC side. I don't know if the original Justice League series came out in the aughts or in the 90s, but in that same era, before live action superheroes. So this kind of, I feel like in a way, Marvel is being clever here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the MCU, as we know it now, like, really wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the X-Men animated series. Like, I thoroughly believe that. Like, they were doing things that brought people to the franchise that maybe, you know, weren't going to comic book shops, and made the X-Men a little bit more accessible and got them into the characters, so that when that first X-Men movie came out, I think in the early 2000s, with Hugh Jackman as Wolverine, you know, that really kind of set the course for the modern MCU. But the one thing I wanted to say is that, you know, the X-Men animated series in the 90s was groundbreaking for a number of reasons. The animation wasn't always fantastic, but it was the first Saturday morning cartoon that dealt with really, really weighty plots and themes, like very adult stuff. Like, this wasn't, you know, it shouldn't have been a kid's cartoon. You know, we're talking about, you know,
it wasn't Challenge of the Super Friends.
Exactly. Exactly. This isn't kind, funny, you know, haha. And then it also wasn't, you know, wrapping everything up in a tidy bow at the end of every episode and then starting the next episode fresh from scratch. Like, they took multi-episodes to finish and complete arcs, and so you really had to be invested in it, which is something that was not happening on any other Saturday morning cartoon. So that was a huge risk they took, and it paid off in spades, and we're seeing the result of that echoing through all of the superhero content and movies since. And now, kind of harking back to the source, we get X-Men 97, which the animation style is almost identical.
It's very similar.
Like, they definitely nailed the aesthetic, but with much better animation and blending in a little bit more CGI, but not in an obstructive way, or a way that's like makes it not seem like it's 90s X-Men.
It's slightly better. There's a sort of certain awkward way the characters move when they talk to each other. I saw someone complain. Well, I've seen some complaints, actually, that this X-Men, this new version of X-Men, is too woke. And I'm the first to criticize woke pandering in source material, but I don't really see it here. I mean, you know, Storm was always from Africa. Gambit was always kind of sexually ambiguous. There has always been this sort of undertone that the X-Men are a metaphor for gays and lesbians being oppressed by society. So I don't really see anything different here, other than that maybe they've made Magneto look kind of like a cheesy hair metal singer.
Yeah, they went with the costume with the big M on it, which a lot of the comic fans thought was like the cheesiest Magneto outfit yet. But it kind of gels with the fact that, you know, at the end of the first episode, we learn that in the place of Professor X, who is somewhere in space, hopefully being cured after an assassination attempt.
Oh, so he could come back. He could come back.
Oh, he's going to come back. Like, believe you me, Professor X is going to come back. But he's just, you know, there's that hole in the X-Men team that they're trying to fill. And then we learn that Magneto has been willed by Xavier or so forth to take over leadership of the X-Men, which of course the X-Men don't like because he was, you know, their enemy and he has shady motives and, you know, all, you know, again, morally complex character. And he doesn't have his helmet on because the helmet was to prevent kind of psychic attacks from Professor X. So out with the helmet, in with the awesome 80s glam metal hair.
I will say the show has, you know, Wolverine is obviously the breakout character of the X-Men, and the show has barely used him at all, I would say, so far. In four episodes, he's barely done anything.
Yeah, I completely agree, which is fascinating because, you know, he's always been the fan favorite.
Yeah.
And everybody likes to dump on Cyclops for being Mr. Goody Two-Shoes and being boring. And
oh, he's horrible.
But, you know, now we're giving him, you know, some difficult choices to make, especially in the third episode when we find out that his pregnant wife,
he has two wives, yeah, I know, is a clone, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
And also an evil witch. Yeah, I know. Tough choices these X-Men have to make on a daily basis, you know. I did see a comedian complain that they had made Rogue's butt smaller.
You know, that was a meme for a long time, Rogue's butt, along with, you know, we have the, you know, Wolverine pining over Jean Grey in the picture that they've used, you know, a gazillion times the internet to apply to whatever situation.
Yeah, it's funny, though. We're talking about this, like, we're both happy to see this back, because I think you and I have talked about this before. The MCU became a little too high on its own supply and just kind of started to get a little turgid and was losing, I think, what people really liked about it. And I feel like X-Men 97 is kind of bringing Marvel back to its roots in some ways. Because I don't know if you watched the season two of What If, which is their other animated series, but that thing was a mess. It was just there was some good stuff in it, but it was also just a lot of big explosions over and over and over again.
Yeah. It was all over the place. You know, I think the thing that I'm really loving the most about X-Men 97, outside of the nostalgia, which is great, is that it's fun. Yeah. And it's like that sense of fun in a comic book show has been, I think, a little lacking in recent years. And it's just so refreshing to kind of dig back into that.
It's old fashioned Saturday morning cartoon. Like if you watch, for instance, Invincible on Amazon Prime, which is like an animated, modern animated take, you know, there's people just getting ripped in half and like their heads getting smashed and eyeballs flying all over the place. And it's the same with The Boys. I'm like, yes, superheroes need to be deconstructed. But X-Men 97, while it's certainly has its share of scares and violence, is not a deconstruction of the superhero mythos. It's a reconstruction of it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, it's fun. And I think it does a really great job balancing the more weighty plot aspects with the levity. I think it's, that's always a challenging balancing act. But I think they do it really, really well.
Yeah, lots of scenes of the X-Men just sitting around eating breakfast.
Exactly. Yeah, and their breakfast looks great too.
God! They always have such an array of pastries.
I would have breakfast in the X-Men mansion. That's my goal.
Anything's possible, Scott. You should just send Marvel a letter. X-Men 97 is airing on Disney Plus. If you're nostalgic for the 90s, which let's face it, it was the best decade, right, Scott? In a lot of ways.
Oh, completely.
It was better than the decade we're in now.
For sure.
At the very least. And X-Men 97 brings it back for a half an hour every week. And you can sit on the couch with a bowl of Fruit Loops or toast or Pop-Tart or whatever and enjoy yourself. May the force be with you. What do they say in the X-Men? I don't even know.
I don't think they have like a catchy sign-off phrase. There's
Assemble. No, that's Avengers Assemble.
That's Avengers. Okay. They say, come to me, my X-Men.
Come to me, my X-Men. Come on. Get in here. Get in here. We're having breakfast. All right, Scott Gold, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Neil.
All right, thank you so much, Scott Gold. Not a mutant, but a mutant sympathizer, I would say. X-Men 97 is now airing on Disney Plus. New episodes every week. All the episodes of Ripley are now on Netflix. You can watch them in black and white and using Rachel Llewellyn's suggestion, maybe with the sound off during a sophisticated dinner party. It's a very sophisticated show for sophisticated people who don't like fun TV. They just like TV that they can talk about on social media. And also thanks to Stephen Garrett for talking to me about Monkey Man, starring, directed, written by, produced by. Maybe he did the cinematography too. Maybe he was the lighting guy. Maybe he was the best boy. He did everything. It was Dev Patel's movie, and it's in theaters now, and you can catch it and probably should catch it as soon as you can. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We are the finest independent pop culture publication on all the internets. Please keep reading the site, and thank you for listening to the show. I will talk to you soon.
Original production.